Thank you. When I was speaking about my talk yesterday with Annie, who is my beloved partner, and Mark, they both suggested that I start with a joke. And Annie, knowing me as she does, leaned in and said, "Russell, just make sure it's funny first." Then added, just to make sure I know what she meant, "You know it's funny if people laugh." So there, that's the joke. You laughed. And it's a great pleasure to be here. But for other sort of comic relief, I'll show you this picture. Between the two of us, Peter and I have fewer chins than we each now have. You know, if I were going to, there are so many people in this audience that I would like to thank, but I do have to make a special area in my thanks for Peter Koch. He has been a lifelong mentor to me, although I rarely say that in front of him, and a friend and a very generous friend. And the generosity I've experienced from knowing him is echoed in the generosity that he and Susan and everybody else involved in Codex show us all by putting on this amazing book fair. So thank you, Peter. Trying to coordinate how I do this. But anyway, so I'll get right going. I know time is short. So in November of 1996, I was looking at this drawing by Rudolf Koch and Fritz Kreidel when, bam, out of nowhere, I had an idea for a typeface. Like a flash, there it was before me, a complete idea. When I say it came out of nowhere, not only had I never designed a typeface, I had never even drawn a letter form before. Nevertheless, I was seized by the idea and spent a sleepless night plotting out a typeface for the Book of Job in my mind. The letter forms in the type would be rigidly geometric and monotone in white in weight to express God's inflexibility, and they would end in small, sharp serifs that would pierce the page as Job had been pierced. All I had to do was figure out how to draw letters, and I would be safely on my way. As you can imagine, my first stab at Job looked an awful lot like Koch and Kreidel's, although it was a lot less interesting. In the end, the alphabet didn't come to much, but in many ways I've spent the last 16 years reckoning with that single night, trying to figure out what precipitated my sudden change of focus. Although I had always thought of myself as a typographic printer, at the end of 1996, my work was veering increasingly away from words. Here are some samples. This is a drawing by Ulf Nilsson, which I branded into handmade paper for our book Elements. A watercolor relief print from my book The Players and Paradigms of the Commedia dell'Arte. A page from Noise 3. And finally, a spread from Incidents, which was a collaboration with Mikhail Magaril. But during that sleepless night of thinking about Job in 1996, it didn't occur to me that the reason my books were moving away from words was the same reason for my sudden inspiration to design a typeface. None of the typefaces available to me were relevant to the content of my work. If I was going to continue to make books, I either had to learn to design my own type or give up printing words. And of course, now I realize it would have been much easier to give up on words, but it's too late for that. So the idea of typeforms being relevant to the content of books is nothing new. In fact, most monuments of bookmaking in my little corner of the world are considered monumental not for their textual content or their images, but for their typefaces. I'll just show you a few, many of which you'll be familiar with. There's Gutenberg, pretty important typeface, you know, considering. The fantastic type from the Teuerdank from 1517. Pierre Moreau's script face from 1648. Bodoni's remarkable pairing of typefaces on the Horace title page. Of course, the Dove's type. And just for fun, Rudolf Koch's Maximilian type. But a more exhaustive display of great books would demonstrate that every 30 to 50 years, or roughly every generation, new typeforms are necessary to keep up with the art and technology of their day. For the golden triumvirate of type, image, and concept to be maintained, all three must be relevant to the time in which a book is produced. So what is a private press printer like me supposed to do when most of the types available, handsome as they may be, are nearly 100 years old? The answer is exactly what I was doing in 1995 and 96, relying more and more heavily on image and concept to bear the graphic weight in my work. I've made a little graph, a handy graph for you. The zero line is sort of the baseline, and in my ideal book, all three colors would be riding along that line, type, image, and concept bearing an equal burden, so to speak, in the book. But as we move away in time from a type's design or revival, the forms of that type become less and less relevant as content in the book, forcing image and concept to do sort of double duty. And I don't think it's going out on a limb to say that since metal type foundries have stopped issuing new metal typefaces, fine press books have relied increasingly on image and concept for their content. So my effort to design type was, I guess, my attempt to bring these three elements back into balance. As I began work on the Job typeface, it quickly became apparent that I needed to understand how individual letters were formed before moving on to a complete alphabet. I realize that this might sound ridiculously self-evident. It is ridiculously self-evident, but it should give you some idea of the absolute zero I was starting from. I knew nothing about designing letters, but I did understand geometry fairly well, so most of my early alphabets were geometrically rendered. There was the Job, and then there was Kronos. This is the title page and Q from the Kronos alphabet. And then the title glyph and abstract letter form from Intersections. You can see how much images of martyrdom were on my mind at the end of 2001. Not long into my studies, I began publishing editioned manuscripts of my alphabets, extremely laborious undertakings in which I would draw and paint the complete alphabet over and over and over again. Job had 7 copies. This is the theta and the Q form from Mu to Promethean alphabet, which also had 7 copies. Gradually, I became entranced with individual letter forms, seeing my paintings as portraits rather than functional objects, and focusing less on how a letter form might work within the community of a typeface, and more on the internal strivings of letters as plastic forms. These ideas really culminated in my book, Eclectic Geometric or Lunch with Nicolette. This is the D and F from that book. And to give you an idea, there are 10 copies of this book, each of which has 26 original paintings done in pencil, liquid watercolor, India ink, and gouache. So 260 paintings, not recommended. This is a close-up of the surface of the page to give you an idea of what it feels like. And then this is the P and the X. So I suppose we all learn things in our own way, but it still surprises me that when seized by a desire to design a typeface, I chose to spend 10 or 12 years painting letter forms that were in no way intended to work together for setting of text. In trying to make words, I tripped inadvertently down the rabbit hole of letter forms, and when I finally came to, I was broke, disoriented, and exhausted, and I exiled myself for 5 years in the wasteland of commercial printing. And then in 2006, something changed. Recently liberated from a bad situation, I began to think about books again. The text that most captured my attention was one I'd been struggling with for 10 years, Henry David Thoreau's translation of Prometheus Bound. Now, printed plays, with few exceptions, are graceless, stilted things, cluttered with character names like so many roadblocks on a highway. Their lack of typographic niceties is generally forgiven because the printed play, except in the most conceptual instances, is not a final form, but in temporary physical distillation between conception and performance. You know, it's supposed to be read aloud, not read like this. But my struggle with Prometheus was that I was printing the play with the intention that it would be the final object in itself. While debating what to do with all those cumbersome character names, one day I realized that there are never more than 2 people speaking to each other at any given time, and everything else fell into place. So at the beginning of each scene or dialogue, I introduce which character is on which side of the page, and then just let the dialogue flow back and forth. For the title page of the book, I drew a contained field of smoke opposite lettering based on Jan van Krimpen's calligraphy. Now, although this is not technically a typeface, each letter in this title was an individual drawing that had to be digitally pasted up, it's still the first time I used my letters to form words in any of my books. Around this time, I started thinking about my relationship to letter forms in a different way, realizing that as a typographic printer, I was most inspired by non-typographic letter forms. Annie had recently given me a Baedeker's Guide to Northern Italy, and I came up with the idea of showing up in the city of Padua for 2 days, following the 1913 Baedeker route, photographing every letter form I saw, evaluating my findings, and then publishing a small book about them. I chose Padua for its proximity to Venice, first of all, but also because every lettering enthusiast I told about the trip said, why would you go to Padua to look at letter forms? Now, while working on the book, I acquired an edition of Catullus printed by John Baskerville and set in his great primer typeface. And though I'd always found later Baskerville revivals uninspiring, I quickly became obsessed with Baskerville's original type. In the space of a month, I drew a version of his typeface, plowed my way through a horribly written manual for FontLab font editing software, and generated my first complete typeface, which I used in Medieval and Padua. It's here on the left, opposite my drawings of 12th century Italian initials, and here on the title page, opposite my map of Padua. Finishing that first typeface opened the typographic floodgates, so to speak, and I quickly began work on a new alphabetical book, Ethelwald, etc. Rather than painting the letters, this book would be printed, with the express caveat that all of the letters be forms that I could not paint as well as I could print. I didn't want it to be a facsimile of one of my gouache alphabets. I wanted it to be something I created on press. And so here we have the D for decorative depravity, which is four-color letterpress. The O for one, which is five-color letterpress. And the R for Rambeau, which is six-color letterpress. Now, in addition to the letters, or non-letters in this case, each letter was paired with a title drawn in an alternate lettering style, and the lot was appended with a section of notes in the back, set in my type Cancelleresca Milanese. This is what I call the general unifying theory behind the work, and I'll just read it before moving forward. The 26 letters in Ethelwald, etc. are born partly of the belief that the communal form of the alphabet is as responsible for a letter's legibility as that letter's specific form. If, for instance, you encounter a portrait of Arthur Rimbaud, you would not necessarily view it as an R. If you encounter the same portrait printed in an alphabet book, following a Q and preceding an S, you would have no doubt that it was an R. Further, the disparity between the letter's contextual legibility and the form's alphabetic ambiguity might open a lane to a fresh appraisal of our typographic assumptions. The complex relationship between the letter and its form might also broaden our understanding of the relationships between communal responsibility and individual prerogative, free will and determinism, heredity and experience, though admittedly this is a stretch. About 3 weeks after finishing this book, we moved to Rome for what would end up being a 9-month fellowship at the American Academy. Cast afloat in the city, our time in Rome was the longest period I've been away from a printing press since I was 18, and so I compensated by doing a lot of drawing. This is one of the walls of my studio. These are some little paintings in black and red, and some other little paintings in a wider palette. But mostly while there, I just designed typefaces. About 6 months after returning to New York, I realized that in addition to the typefaces I had drawn in Rome, I had a few others under my belt. And maybe it was time to make a type specimen, a book focusing on complete alphabets rather than individual letters. Specimens of diverse characters, the book that came out of this, would also allow me to experiment further with some of the color printing techniques I had begun to explore with Ethelwald, etc. So here's the Arthur Rimbaud page from Specimens. All of my alphabetical books have recurring characters that appear in them, Euclid, Prometheus, Vitruvius, and for some reason Arthur Rimbaud. So there's his page. Here's the Prometheus page, which is two-color letterpress with candle smoke drawn directly on the paper in the middle. Horace page. And then the Harry Carter page. Now, while working on this page, which reads, "Type is something that you can pick up and hold in your hand," I decided that printing the text from a polymer plate was conceptually inexcusable, which is what I print most of my types from. For a few years, I had been thinking about the possibility of having a proprietary typeface cast in metal, and hearing that Dan Morris and Micah Currier had recently purchased the Dale Guild, I decided to give it a try. As it turned out, the working protocol by which I make my digital typefaces transferred remarkably easily to the Guild's 19th century tools. So as part of the deluxe edition, Harry Carter's passage came set in the actual type in the back of the box. It's not kerned, just so you know. But the process of making this type worked so well that we then decided to make another one for the book for the William Morris page, the type Nicholas. And as part of the deal I made with the Guild, we released this font in this type in fonts to coincide with the publishing of the book. So it turned out that the type specimen that was intended to display types that you couldn't buy actually had one, you could. Now, although most people think of Nicholas as a titling face, one printer who clearly hates me wrote me to say what a perfect Christmas font it was. My intent when designing it was that it be used for continuous text. So after receiving a large font of it, I printed an edition of the Book of Jonah to finally see it in its intended setting, a wall of words reminiscent of epigraphic mosaics, Champlivé enamel, and 12th century manuscripts. So the last book I'm going to speak about this morning is the one I'm currently working on. Like most of my books, it has a title that just rolls off the tongue. Interstices and Intersections, or An Autodidact Comprehends a Cube, 13 Euclidean Propositions. Chosen not for their relationship to each other, but for their relevance in my life, the 13 propositions in the book will be printed with accompanying diagrammatics and then paired with a companion textual and visual commentary of my own. Although many people develop a kind of nervous tic at the mention of geometry, flashing back to uncomfortable schoolroom memories, geometry has always been my principal means of interpreting the world. I use it to draw, I contemplate it to calm myself, and I play with it for fun, all of which I'm trying to express in the book. As a working method, I'm painting all of the spreads first and then figuring out how to convert those paintings into prints. And so here's one of my work tables. On the top, you see a proof. Below it are three paintings of forms. Then below that is a separation, drawings in separation to turn those paintings into printing plates and figure out ways to addition them. Because of this process, most of the spreads that I've designed so far require 10 to 14 press runs each. There are 32 spreads in the book. The text will be set in a... Oh, here, I have images for you. So here you see in the upper left, Euclid's proposition set in the italic type. Below it is a triangle that has ABC around it, which becomes the diagram typically associated and needed to interpret the proposition. And then on the right, my text begins. And the illustrations, hopefully or ideally, illustrate both texts. That is a trompe l'oeil print of a sheet of loose leaf paper, which makes me very happy. This is how to find the center of a circle. And I'm very early on these are proofs of a book that will be another year in the making. So a lot of stuff can change here. But all of the text that you see will be hand set in a new proprietary metal type family that I'm having made that involves 186 unique characters, 23 of which are Fs and F ligatures. Now, because the treatment of each proposition goes over two spreads, Dan Kelm and I are working to try to design a binding that will work both as a traditional codex and fold out in a way that you can see both spreads or as many spreads as you want at a time. We have an initial dummy on my table that is not successful, but it looks like the book will look. Just the structure doesn't work, so this is the binding of the standard edition. Now, finally, presenting my work in this way is always a little disorienting because it all seems to fit into a logical, linear narrative. First black and white letters, then colored letters, then words and images. When at the time, each change in direction was fraught with anxiety and uncertainty, teetering back and forth between inspiration and exhaustion. The logic only comes afterward. When I'm working on a book, I'm not thinking about how it fits into a program. I make books because I can't not make them. All I can hope is that when I look back in 10 years at what I'm making now, I'll see the beginning of some other idea. Thank you. No, I don't know where the best coffee is. Yes, Carolee? No, Carolee's got a question. Yes, she wanted to know if there was one of my types that was not proprietary, which means other people can use it. Most of the time, I don't let anyone use my types, except Annie has somehow managed to use one of them. But we're still arguing about that. Yes, the Nicholas face, which Jonah is set in, is available from the Dale Guild in fonts. And then for that book, we also made a suite of diaper pattern ornaments called Lisbon ornaments, and they're available in fonts as well. The reality of buying a diaper pattern in fonts is a little discouraging because, of course, to really see the diaper, you need a lot of it, and the fonts are very small. So, but there it is. You can buy it, and I think if you go to the Dale Guild's website, they have a link. Yes. Rush to the phone. It's going fast, you know. Yes. Right. Well, that's a very... did everybody hear? She wants to know about my decision to make proprietary typefaces while all along I'm saying there aren't any viable types for people to use, basically. And, well, there are many reasons. One, I'm not actually opposed theoretically to selling my type. But the first of all, I'm self-taught, and so I have the, you know, one of the qualities of autodidacts is I'm perpetually uncertain as to whether I'm any good at it. So that's one problem, and I don't want to open myself up to critique unnecessarily. And but the other is that when I'm designing a typeface, I only design the characters I need. And the idea of designing a yen and a euro and a dollar sign, all that stuff, it's just insufferably boring to me. So the problem is that if someone bought my face, they'd say, wait, I can't do everything I want with it. So I've been developing the idea of trying to work with a young type designer that I know who will sort of make my typefaces into complete typefaces under my supervision, and then perhaps selling them, selling letterpress-specific digital fonts. So, you know, the big problem with, there are lots of great contemporary typefaces, but if you put them on a polymer plate and run them through your Vandercook, they look, you know, 5 degrees heavier than they're supposed to, and they usually look ugly. I mean, just, you know, because you're not giving the image that the designer considered and put all their effort into. And so this idea is interesting to me of having a resource of digital typefaces available that are meant specifically for printing letterpress. And but I just don't have the time, so it'll have to be something that works, and right now it's not. One last question. David Esselman. I have, and I spoke with Stan Nelson about outfitting me and teaching me, and after getting the 16-page tool list, most of which had to be manufactured by me, I realized that you have to decide where you enter the process, and the finished book is what I need to have in my life more than going even further back in the making of type. So I think that, I don't think that will happen. Yeah. You're welcome.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.